The Cold Omaha Podcast Network. Hey guys, and before we get to the show, just want to let you know, brand new podcast called The Andy Carlson Show. Original, I know. Sports and other stuff coming at you 5 days a week, part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. So, you have the show, visit andycarlsonshow.com/podcast or get it on Stitcher and iTunes. All right, on with the show.
All right, welcome back to another edition of Midwest Swing. This is episode number 7. You can find us on Twitter at Midwest Swing Pod. We are under the Cold Omaha Podcast Network at Cold Omaha MN. I am your host, Brandon Warren, at Brandon underscore Warren, W-A-R-N-E. I am joined by my producer and maestro, Andy Carlson, at Andy Carlson Show. Andy, how are we doing today?
I'm fantastic. What's good in the hood?
Well, we're finally getting a show today. We, due to circumstances beyond our control yesterday, could not record with Chris Crawford of Baseball Prospectus. Hopefully we can get that going again in the near future. We had some pretty good stuff planned for him. He's a very good guest. We did manage to find somebody else from Baseball Prospectus. That's Brian Grosnick. Am I saying that right, Brian?
I go either way, but Grosnick is the typical pronunciation.
Grosnick. Okay. Well, I will know for next time. You can be found on Twitter at bgrosnick with a K at the end. And so I when I put out the sheet for us to kind of bounce some ideas back and forth, you have quite the rap sheet of things you're working on right now. Do you want to do a little rundown so people know where they can find you once we're done recording here?
Yeah, that's great. So I'm doing a lot of writing for Baseball Prospectus, transaction analysis, things like that. I also am a columnist for BP Boston, so I cover the Red Sox pretty heavily for them. And then also I do some work now and then for Beyond the Box Score. And then I just started a podcast of my own, The Four-Man Rotation, which I do with Craig Goldstein, Matt Corey, and Brian Joyner. So yeah, I'm all over the place.
Feels like everyone's having a podcast now. Do you ever get the feeling there's more podcasts than there are listeners?
Oh, all the time, especially for our podcast. I think we have more hosts than listeners at this point.
Oh my gosh, yeah, sometimes it's a little frustrating. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. Look for Midwest Swing. I believe we're the only one under that name. Not true of my other podcast, which is The Breakdown. That's hard to find because there's a lot of podcasts called The Breakdown. Ooh, this one's a little easier.
What's
to find
a podcast?
Yeah, no kidding. The maestro. It's a little banter there. So, Brian, I like to begin each of these podcasts, especially if it's a guest that I haven't had before, with a little bit of an introduction. First and foremost, you know, people, if they know you from Twitter, probably have an idea, obviously, of your baseball acumen. I think I know you best or knew you best from Beyond the Box Score. You're a Mets fan, but where are you from? You know, where did you go to school and all that stuff?
So I split my time growing up between Florida and New Jersey. That's probably where I got the Mets fandom, is from New Jersey and from my father, who's been a Mets fan. He was born in Brooklyn and kind of raised a Mets fan. After that, I got my undergraduate degree in writing at Florida State University in Tallahassee, Florida, and then got a graduate degree in instructional systems design, which is very, very unexciting way of making a living. So I do that as well as the baseball thing. So yeah, I'm a Florida State Seminole, for better or for worse.
Yeah, with all the news coming out of there in the last couple of years, there's obviously some caveats there, I suppose, you have to make when it comes up in conversation. What drove you to baseball, or what was your baptism by fire to the game? How were you introduced to the game, and at what age did you start really gravitating towards that as a sport?
So I guess it was pretty much from the beginning. I mean, it's always been my favorite sport. I kind of entered Mets fandom with my father a little after the 1986 World Series win. So yeah, spoiler alert, I'm a little older, I guess, than the average baseball blogger. At the same time, I've never really cared for other sports as much as I like baseball. I mean, I played Little League, but I played a lot of sports when I was a kid. It's just baseball seemed to stick with me, and it's always kind of been my favorite sport. Went to Yankees games, went to Mets games growing up. And then after that, kind of with the advent of sabermetrics, I got very much into Rob Neyer and Keith Law at ESPN, read Baseball Prospectus. I think the first annual I own is the 2003 Prospectus annual. So I've been kind of got caught up in the sabermetrics thing as kind of a nerdy kid. And then kind of from there, just stuck with it and started writing about baseball probably around 2012 and just been into it since then.
Yeah, for me, I think it was the 2000, I'm looking at it right now, 5 Baseball Prospectus annual was probably my first, between that and Moneyball, I read, I think in my freshman year or my first year of college, I went to a small college for 2 years before I got my undergrad done, was at Northwestern, but that was kind of my introduction to the sabermetric side of the game. I was also a member of a forum, funny enough, at baseball.com. It was called NetSports, and I went from a guy talking about home runs, RBIs, and batting average to understanding why on-base percentage was a big deal. And, you know, sabermetrics, I don't know that it was in its infancy then. I think the infancy would have been the Bill James books that came out well before we had any idea what was going on. But I think it was still, you know, a very young, very new concept. And so to come up and learn about it as other people were learning about it, I think has given me a little bit of an advantage to that rather than people that have kind of been late to the game and had to play a lot of catch up. But how do you find yourself dealing with like these new age stats when you watch a game, especially since, you know, we find out more and more that some of them have flaws that we need to account for, you know, the wins above replacement and like that. How do you feel about trying to reconcile traditional baseball versus the new age stats when you try to write a piece, especially for the intelligent places you write for?
Well, that's definitely a challenge. There's no doubt about that. And with a lot of newer stats, we kind of are understanding more of the context of that they're in. Mm-hmm. Where is it appropriate to start talking about true average or WOBA from FanGraphs? Where is it appropriate for us to start talking about, you know, batting average and the traditional statistics? It's a tough thing to manage. I think the toughest thing is really understanding what the limitations are of all the new statistics. When we have something new like, you know, catcher framing at Baseball Prospectus, or if we have something new like, you know, the StatCast data, I have to work really hard to keep up with that because, you know, like anybody else, it's new for me and it's mm-hmm. it's not always super intuitive. So understanding where the limitations are, I mean, that's tough. It's a constant challenge and it's something that all good writers have to work against.
Yeah, I agree with that. As far as your rooting interest, too, you mentioned being a long-term Mets fan. How has that been for you in the suffering department, especially since, you know, between 86 and this last year? You know, there were some up years, but I think they've always kind of been considered the second-tier team in New York during that era.
Yeah, no question. Being a Mets fan is – you have to reconcile yourself with extreme expectations. Expectations are almost always high in New York, and expectations are almost always high for the Mets. They get a lot of hype with the Generation K pitching prospects, which was really my first my first descent into Mets fandom was a lot around the Generation K stuff. After that, it kind of, you learn to have these high expectations, the Strawberries, the Goodens, the Generation K, Bobby Bonilla, all those kind of things. And then you always have those expectations kind of cut out from underneath you, which makes the last couple of seasons kind of nice because we've had relatively low expectations as Mets fans. And this year was a definite surprise in 2015. We exceeded expectations for a change. So it kind of exercises some of those old ghosts.
Who is the most disappointing Met in your lifetime? Would it be like Mo Vaughn, Roberto Alomar? Who comes to mind for you in that discussion?
Oh, that's a really good one. So Alomar definitely was. Man, I thought he was going to be just the best when he came over to the Mets.
I mean, he basically fell apart. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but he literally fell apart like right then, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, it was one of the worst seasons of his career was as soon as he came to New York, so that was awful. I do think the most disappointing one for me is I was super into Paul Wilson when he was the number one prospect for the Mets. He was taken really highly, and I thought for sure he was going to be the next Tom Seaver, Dwight Gooden guy, and he just was the opposite of that, although he did have actually an okay career in Cincinnati.
Yeah, you look at Alomar, to digress, 956 OPS, slugged 541 with the Cleveland club. in 2001, 2002 with the Mets, 708 OPS, 376 slugging. In his post-Cleveland days, for the last 3 years of his career, at a 698 OPS. Coming into that, and obviously, you know, he got his younger years, 833. So, yeah, it was a pretty big disappointment, and that's, I think that's why that resonated so strongly with me, was just the incredible disappointment that he was, and Mo Vaughn as well. You did briefly mention the last couple years. How much did the 2015 run take you by surprise, and at what point in the season did you start to think, yeah, this team has a chance to be something more than just, hey, maybe get into the playoffs, but to actually make a run?
Wow, it was probably pretty late, truthfully.
That's what I figured.
Yeah, it really, the Mets got off to a scorching hot start in April, and I, like a lot of people, thought it was a mirage.
I remember DJ Short saying, we don't know if the Mets will ever lose again.
Right.
On April 14th or something like that last year.
Yeah, and that's what it seemed like for a little bit, but they were winning due to dumb luck. I mean, the team was playing pretty well, but it was not like they were a true talent. They should have been ripping off 10 wins at a time. And so, you know, after they cooled off after that, we think, okay, well, now it's more kind of like what we expect from the Mets. They're maybe about an even 81-win team or something like that. The David Wright news came out that he had the spinal stenosis and that, you know, his career was actually kind of in jeopardy for a little bit. And that really brought me down. I really thought that that was kind of the leading or lagging indicator that this was the point where the Mets were going to disappoint me for the rest of the season. The time when it turned around was the day after, for me at least, the day after the Wilmer Flores non-trade. Where the team had this brutal, brutal situation where they left Wilmer Flores out on the field to play. He was crying his eyes out because he had heard that he was being traded to the Brewers for Carlos Gomez. It's a pretty famous story by now. Mm-hmm. And then after that, they went out, they got Yoenis Cespedes. But the way that the team kind of changed their tone, it seemed like this was the typical Lowell Mets, you know, making silly decisions, not putting anybody's best interests ahead of themselves. But Flores really kind of almost galvanized the fan base as, you know, these are guys we can root for. They're humans. We like them. And then immediately after that, Cespedes came on. The team was kind of struggling to keep up with the Nationals before then they ripped it off after that. I really think that it was the first, you know, week of August that I really thought, okay, not only is this a great team, but look how they're loaded for the postseason.
And you mentioned that Flores supposed trade. What were the particulars? I had a baseball game that night, so I never got really into it because it had happened and fallen apart while I was playing. Was it Wilmer Flores and Zach Wheeler for Carlos Gomez, or how was the trade as reported supposed to happen?
Yeah, that's exactly it. It was that 1-for-2 deal. It was supposed to be Carlos Gomez for Flores and Wheeler straight up, which from my perspective at the time, I thought was a really nice trade for the Mets. I thought that would have been wonderful.
A win-win, really, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I was a big Carlos Gomez booster before they traded him to the Twins for as part of that Johan Santana package. Mm-hmm. And since that time, he'd gone from being a 70 runner and not much else to, you know, a real power threat, a real double threat in center field. And the Mets needed a center fielder. Eventually, they got not a center fielder. They got Yoenis Cespedes, who is going to play center field. But I do think that that was a good win-win trade for both sides. Now, going back now and looking at what they wound up doing, which is where they traded a top prospect in Michael Fulmer for Cespedes, but they get to hold on to Flores and Wheeler. I really like that for them, too. It's kind of the best of both worlds.
How is your perception on Carlos Gomez traded since, excuse me, how is your perception on Carlos Gomez changed since the Mets didn't get him and then he kind of floundered for the Astros? Do you still think he's got bounce back potential, or has his star faded a little bit for you?
Well, I think it's faded a little bit. I think he's maybe 90% of the player I thought he was before the trade to the Astros and the difficulties he's had in Houston. But I do think a lot of that's injury-based. He hasn't been healthy. And I do think that if he does get healthy, he can be pretty close to the player that he was. But once you have one injury, I mean, that's kind of, you know, a leading indicator for more injuries. So you never know for sure. But I do think he's going to have a nice little bounce-back season in Houston.
So in retrospect, you feel like the Mets made the right trade?
Yeah, I can't argue with how good Cespedes was after the trade. So, I mean, nobody expected him to be an MVP caliber player as soon as he came over to the Mets. So, yeah, it had to have worked out well. Just because the team didn't win the World Series, it's hard to see that as anything other than a success.
Well, what I want to focus on is also keeping Zach Wheeler, who I really like from a strikeouts ground ball standpoint. Obviously, still working his way back from, if I'm not mistaken, is a Tommy John surgery?
Yeah, he's had a couple of different arm issues,
Sure.
but yes, the Tommy John surgery is the big thing that he's recovering from.
So if he can prove that he's physically capable of handling the first year back workload, whether that's 150 innings or whatever they feel comfortable, maybe it's even less than that. Do you think that opens the floodgates for them to move Matt Harvey in the future? Or what do you think is the plan with all these arms? Obviously, it's a rotation that's pretty stocked with solid arms. What do you think is the next plan for them to kind of clear that logjam a little bit?
Yeah, I don't think they see it as a logjam at all. I think in a perfect
I
world,
think smart teams don't. That's to be honest with you. You can't have too much
right.
pitching, so good point.
I think in a perfect world, the Mets see this as we've got 2 more years where we're going to run out there these 5 guys. We're going to go Harvey, DeGrom, Syndergaard, Mats, and Wheeler. I don't think Wheeler's coming back until June or July of this year, so
Okay.
I think he's going to wind up with like 100 innings or 120, and they'll backfill with Bartolo Colon, which is kind of awesome. But I really don't think this is a team that's going to be in any hurry to move Matt Harvey at all, or any of these guys. And I'm not very popular among Mets fans for thinking this. I'm very concerned that one of the DeGrom or Syndergaard is not going to make it through this season. I mean, there are just too many pitchers that have Tommy John surgery. It would not surprise me at all that one of those guys goes out for an extended period of time, either this year or next year, and then there's no logjam at all. Then it's all hands on deck.
So, what was your perception of the team's chance of re-signing Cespedes, and then how do you feel about the deal that was ultimately struck? So, in essence, I guess what I'm asking is, how pessimistic were you in September and October that they'd bring him back, and then how relieved were you once they were able to, even though you saw the deal that might have been a little bit on the high side?
Yeah, extremely pessimistic and extremely relieved. I thought the Mets had maybe a 10% chance of bringing him back during this offseason. It just did not seem like something where the Mets could afford to do it. The deal that they signed him to, I honestly think, is a great deal for both the Mets
Sure.
and for Cespedes, because I think Cespedes is going to get a really nice long-term deal at the end of this year. I don't think there's any chance he comes back to the Mets after this year. I think he opts out. I think he has a 4-win season, something reasonable, not like his crazy 2015. And then he goes out and he gets a nice little contract from the White Sox or the Angels or somebody else,
Yep.
and everybody moves on and everybody's kind of happy, because the Mets can't afford another long-term, big money, $25, $27 million contract.
What's the contingency plan behind Cespedes? Is it just to give center back to Lagares long term? Or do you think they're just kind of wait and see mode? Because if he doesn't have a great season and doesn't opt out, which again is probably a 10% outcome, they're not getting too far ahead of themselves for something that they can't really plan for either way.
Yeah, the team's really high on Lagares. I've lost a little bit of the luster that I feel like Lagares has. I'm concerned about his defense. He wasn't a very highly touted defensive player before he had his major league breakout. He wasn't very much of a prospect at all. They were concerned he could stick in center field. They thought he might have to move to a corner. And he has a beautiful defensive season back in 2014. He gets his extension, and then in 2015, everything just kind of falls apart. He definitely needs arm surgery. His arm is not right. So I expect the Mets to try to give him every opportunity. And failing that, I expect them to give every opportunity to Brandon Nimmo in center field. But regardless, either Cespedes or Granderson or both will be gone at the end of this year. And whichever one, if Cespedes does wind up sticking around, he could easily move into right field.
Yeah, Nimmo was the name that it wasn't coming to mind right away, but that's kind of their crown jewel prospect out there with Conforto, and then you just kind of roll with the punches with the third guy out there. But that's a really nice outfield foundation, I would think.
Yeah, I really hope so. I mean, Nimmo really does need to prove that he can hit as well as he can reach base. As you know, covering the Twins, guys who just reach base and don't necessarily hit for a lot of
Sounds like Aaron
power.
Hicks.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just very possible he could wind up getting overlooked in the future. So it's possible that he's going to be a fourth outfielder. It's positive he could be an okay starter, but there's still a lot of error bars on him, whether or not he's going to be a star, a regular, or something else.
Why do you think teams are so hesitant to commit to Yoenis Cespedes in his career? You've seen him bounce around with, what is it, 4 teams now in a span of just a few years, and his market didn't provide him with, I think, the 5-year deal or whatever he was looking for. What is going on that you think teams are so, or am I misreading the situation that the teams would commit to him, but he's just not finding the right fit for him?
I don't think you're misreading the situation. I think teams in general are hesitant to commit to long-term contracts for corner outfielders who are not, you know, Jason Hayward or Justin Upton, who are very young players as well. This new opt-out culture is changing things a little bit, but teams know now that there's a lot of sabermetrically savvy front offices, I think teams know that committing big money and long-term deals to corner outfielders isn't the best possible use of resources. And especially if you look at a lot of these top prospect lists, there's a ton of outfield talent out there right now. I mean, guys who have strength, speed, can play center field. I think teams, generally speaking, want to roll the dice with younger guys whenever they can. And I do think some of the teams that could afford a Cespedes didn't really need him. And some of the teams that wanted a Cespedes, like the Angels or the White Sox, didn't have the finances to be able to go out and get him.
You mentioned the opt-out culture. What is your assessment of that? Do you like it? Because personally, for me, I like anything that swings a little bit of leverage back in the player's favor.
Yeah, I'm totally with you on that. I think the players, I'd always rather see the players benefit from a deal than the owners. At the same time, the opt-out culture I don't love because I do love it when players stay with the same team for an extended period of time. I love when players are 10 years, 12 years with the same
team. Well, you've got David Wright, we've got Joe Mauer, we had Kirby Puckett, so I definitely can relate on that level.
Yeah, I would love to see players be able to do better with their teams that are sticking with them. So from that perspective, I don't love the opt-outs, but they're good for the players. So, you know, and it definitely makes things more interesting come off-season time.
For a bit of a local angle, and probably not a huge one because Twins fans never saw this guy, but Sean Gilmartin came over to the Mets as a Rule 5 pick. Basically, I think it boiled down to the Twins letting Gilmartin go, picking up J.R. Graham, which probably wasn't the worst move. What was your perception of Gilmartin as the season went on last year for the Mets?
I think he's just fine. I think he's a really good option as your second left-hander out of the bullpen. Mm-hmm. He's got talent. He can go more than one inning, which is really nice, especially when you've got a lefty, and especially when you're facing some of the really powerful lineups that are pouncing around the National League right now. So I like him. I think he's a long-term piece for the next 3 years in this Mets bullpen. But obviously the front office doesn't feel exactly the same way because they've gone out and tried to supplement their left-handed pitching with some other guys like Jerry Blevins again. So I'm not sure they're as high on him as I am, but I thought he pitched really well last year.
I mean, how much are you really married to a Rule 5 guy, I guess, becomes the point. But at the same time too, I think the Twins did fine to go out and get a hard throwing right-hander because they didn't need another soft tossing lefty. But it looked to me like Gilmartin was trusted a little bit more in bigger roles as the season wore on, based on some of the leverage stats that I saw on Baseball Reference. Was that your perception as well watching the games?
You know, I don't really think that the Mets were super excited about Gilmartin in high leverage roles at any point. I really feel like they had such weaknesses in their bullpen that it was more of a necessity than they were really excited about using him.
Well, I can definitely relate to that, having watched the Twins bullpen last year. And obviously, they threw J.R. Graham into the fire pretty quickly. If you remember, he broke Alex Rios's wrist, I believe, in like one of his first or second appearances in the big leagues. And then it was pretty clear, like, look, this is a Rule 5 guy that's super excitable, and you got to protect a guy like that. So it'll be interesting to see. You know, I, as a Twins guy here in the Twin Cities, I like to keep an eye on what former Twins did. But, you know, hope for the best for Gilmartin, and honestly, to get him for Ryan Domet, who did absolutely nothing for the Braves, wasn't a bad move. Now, one thing I wanted to ask you about before we move on to more specific stuff, as we're probably going into the longest podcast intro of all time, what are your interests outside of the game? I hear dogs barking in the background. That might be part of it.
Yeah, that's sorry about that. I do have two dogs with my wife. Other than that, I do a lot of running. I've run a couple of marathons and done a couple of I've done one half Ironman triathlon. So that's my big interest outside of baseball and baseball statistics.
I do 26 miles every day, but it's driving to my office in Minneapolis. that's about the extent of mine. I'm a little bigger bodied guy, you know, think like Jabba Chamberlain. So I'm more about the lifting and elliptical, but I definitely have a lot of respect for the marathon runners. Glenn Perkins' wife is a marathon runner. So when we have her on the radio at 96.3, it's fun to hear about how they chase those endorphins and all that. Like, what's the longest you've run in one fell swoop?
In one session, it's only been the 26.3. A couple of marathons, I did the Chicago and the Detroit, and then I'm in a couple of months, I'm running the Kentucky Derby marathon. But I've never been tempted to go longer than the 26.2
I
and
suspect
finish
not.
it.
I suspect not.
Well, my wife actually though is she wants to do an ultra marathon. She's going to start her first training for a 50K pretty soon. So,
Holy smokes. And
yeah.
I'm almost like just awestruck. What's your best time finishing a marathon?
It's my second one that I did. So about 4 hours and 26 minutes, I think it was. So I'm hardly one of those super fast guys. I'm more just going out there grinding it out and getting it done. I'm the David Eckstein of the marathon circuit,
Well,
except without the rings.
so you're going to get some Hall of Fame votes when you're eligible, is that right?
Yeah, that's the plan.
So we had discussed the Pecota release. That's a big day in the off season for baseball prospectus. And what were your initial thoughts with it coming out? Obviously, there was some salt on Twitter between Jose Bautista, which actually probably was pretty good for baseball prospectus's brand. I hate to use that word brand, it kind of channeling my inner Darren Revelle. But between that and then John Heyman kind of ripping it, felt like there's obviously some misplaced angst towards it. There was also that article that was circulating around last night. I think it was somebody by the name of Feinstein that had written that. What's your initial feeling about this release?
Well, I think it's like any other projection system release. There's 90% of it is really good, useful stuff, and 10% of it are things where if you look at the context of how baseball is played, no projection system's ever going to capture it. Pecota's been low on the Royals for a couple of years now. So, what do we try to think about? Is it that Pecota is just always right, and that what we're seeing is really a fluke thing, or is there something that the system's not capturing? I think there's room for both interpretations, though in the case of the Royals, I think that maybe the system doesn't exactly capture what makes them a great team. The same thing was kind of true for the Giants a little while back as well, and with the Giants being going into an even year, I think there's a decent chance they'll win 110 games. So, and Pecota's not going to project that. And the other thing about the projection systems is they always tend to kind of go low on everybody. No projection system's ever going to project Bryce Harper to repeat the season he had last season. No projection system's ever going to project that young center field prospect's going to come up and be Mike Trout, but they'll kind of tend to go low on a lot of people or go high on really low performers. I like that. I think that's useful for us to kind of manage our expectations. And then it's great when the stuff goes completely awry and we have all the weird stuff that happens in baseball.
Is there a compulsion after the Mets did, or not the Mets, excuse me, the Royals did what they did last year to go under the hood and look at it a little bit, or is it just like shrug emoji where you're like, hey, that's baseball?
No, I think it's worth looking under the hood, absolutely. When we look at things about the Royals, like their bullpen and their ability to make contact, I mean, those are things that don't show up and warp the same way that they do on the field, and they tend to chain together. They tend to create outcomes which are out of the realm of what we usually use a projection system to project because things tend to collapse on each other. One good thing leads to another. And so I definitely think it's worth looking under the hood and seeing maybe we can implement cluster luck a little bit more. Maybe there's some things that we could add into the soup to make things better. Although the what the folks who develop Pecota do and Steamer and Zips and all these other projection systems, they're taking a lot into account and they're way smarter than I am. So I kind of trust that they also know what they're doing.
What are the things you like most about Pecota if you were to look at it from a distance? Maybe not necessarily if you were more of a consumer and less of a producer.
Well, about Pecota in general, I really like that Baseball Prospectus puts together percentile forecasts.
Yeah,
They
I
give you
like
a
that. I
lot.
like that a lot too.
Yeah, that's really great. So you can see, okay, well, most of the times they run Pecota, this is the stat line you can project. But you know what? The margins, well, wow, there's a big difference between what's possible for Giancarlo Stanton than there might be what's possible for a Jose Iglesias or an Aaron Hicks, somebody like that. And so that's really useful to me. And then the percentages that they do for attrition, improvement, breakout, and collapse, those are really neat too, because what are the chances that a player is going to have a breakout season? I mean, that's always fun to look at. And you look at some guys and they have huge numbers for these things. So you really want to dig deeper and be like, okay, well, what makes this person a breakout candidate? And those are a nice little shorthand to get there.
Anything about it that you dislike, even if it's not an active dislike or it's something that just might kind of get on your nerves just a little bit? Obviously, I don't want you to trash the company, but
never, never. The one thing that I guess it disappoints me sometimes is I look at the Pagoda projections and it's like, oh, Clayton Kershaw is projected for 5 wins above replacement player. I disagree with it. I think that he's greater than the system makes him out to be. And I do think when you have the benefit of everybody kind of regressing towards the mean of it, you also miss out a little bit on some of these guys where it's like, you know, no, Bryce Harper's probably going to be closer to what he was last year than he was next year. So I don't buy it. And when I have my own disagreements with the system, it can be a little bit of a disappointment at times, though you go back and you readjust your expectations. But that's usually it with this or any other projection systems is just, well, they tend to be really conservative.
Well, they got the Mets, the Cubs, the Dodgers as the division champions in the NL. The NL is crazy this year. We'll talk about that as well. Astros winning the West, I can't complain about that. Cleveland finally cashing in on some of that potential in the Central, but you knew I had to ask you about the American League East. Tampa Bay with 91 wins, a 3-game cushion on Boston, a 5-game on the Yankees, 5 on the Blue Jays, 6 on the Yankees, and a 19-game lead on Baltimore. What are your thoughts on Tampa Bay going into this season?
I think they're going to be a better team than they were last season. That's about as far as I'm willing to go with the hot takes in the AL East.
Yeah,
I agree with the Orioles being the worst team in that division. And then now they're talking about getting Fowler and Gallardo, which could change the calculation a little bit. But the other 4 teams in that division, I mean, they all have really strong cases to do well. I would have expected the Red Sox and the Jays to be the top 2 teams in that division based on Pagoda. I don't think the Rays have the depth that those other teams do. You know, when you roll with Brad Miller as your starting shortstop, you know, sometimes bad things are going to happen.
I thought he was the best shortstop in the American League.
Well, he definitely was a couple of years ago. Don't taunt Dave Cameron too much about that.
No, he's still my boss. I got to be good to him. I just like to have a little bit of a needle jab when I get a chance.
Sure. I think that division's going to be a nightmare to try to project for the next couple of seasons. Everybody's really tightly packed. I mean, it's like that throughout the American League, really. There are very few teams that are bad and a lot of teams that are pretty good. So I just throw up my hands. I'm like, yep, sure, whatever Pagoda says, whatever the FanGraphs projections say, you can make a case for anything, I think.
Now, I want to back up a little bit on the Orioles. I started writing for the Baltimore Sports and Life website, so I've kind of dived in headlong into my indoctrination on the Orioles and I think filling in the margins, you know, obviously Dexter Fowler is not a huge needle mover, but he's a pretty nice player. And Gallardo's obviously a polarizing guy in sabermetric circles, just because his strikeout rate has declined so much in the last 4 years. But if you're looking at a team that needs to fill in the margins, that's got to be one of the teams that stands out with, you know, Fowler atop that order, if it allows you to move Manny Machado down to drive in a few more runs and really how that line shakes out that lineup. I think that's a team that has a lot to gain if they can get those 2 guys signed. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you look at that lineup as it is now, it's good. It's not a bad lineup. They can score some runs. But then if you readjust your expectations where, okay, maybe the top 5 hitters in that lineup are going to be Fowler, Machado, Adam Jones, Chris Davis, and Mark Trumbo, that doesn't look like a pretty good lineup. That looks like a really good lineup all of a sudden. And Jonathan Scope at the end of that. And
maybe J.J. Hardy has a bounce back.
Well, I mean, as a Twins guy, I'm sure you've been hoping for that for about, you know, 6-7 years.
I mean, it's not terribly likely, but at the same time, he'll give you defense and power. It's not nothing, I guess.
Absolutely. So that changes things a lot for them. The other thing about the Orioles adding Fowler or Gallardo is the guys that they would be replacing are basically replacement level. I mean, the Orioles rotation is awful. It is so bad.
And you know what? I saw Ted Berg ranked it better than the Royals. What do you think about that?
I think they're both really bad.
I know. It's amazing, though. I do see a poor man's Royal situation going here, because the FanGraphs projections, if I'm allowed to speak that in your midst, have 5 guys that are projected to strike out at least a batter per inning. So I don't. It's not necessarily emulation in terms of being, you know, the sincerest form of flattery, but at the same time, they've got a manager that can push the buttons in that bullpen and a rotation that's not going to be very good. And I don't even know if Dylan Bundy is considered one of those guys that's supposed to be a factor for them in the bullpen in those projections. It kind of feels like they're almost kind of imitating them.
Yeah, I don't think it's by choice. I think it's more by accident. But
Yeah.
absolutely, they definitely could be considered that. The one thing that they have on the Royals is that they're not the same contact hitting team that the Royals are. They're more of a power. I mean,
And
especially adding out
they don't
Trumbo.
play defense like the Royals either, but at the same time, you just nobody's going to be the exact same. It's sort of like why prospect guys hate comps. It's because
Sure.
nobody's the same person. But I can kind of see like a framework where it's like, okay, I can see, this is a division that's going to be hotly contested, and you got to do your own thing, you got to go your own way. Maybe this could work.
Absolutely, it could. And you mentioned the manager knowing to push the right buttons. I don't think it can be understated the effect that Buck Showalter has on that team, whether it's from a clubhouse management perspective, or he does tend to make very good decisions as a bullpen manager and the way he runs his team on the field as well. I don't think he's a bad, kind of tactical manager as well. So I think that definitely gives them an advantage. They're one of the few teams in Major League Baseball that I think, you know what, their manager does give them a legitimate, documentable advantage over the average team.
Now, Pakoda agrees with you that their pitching is bad. 786 projected runs allowed, worst in baseball. Now, the rotation stinks, and if the defense has Mark Trumbo in right field on a regular basis, that's obviously got to play a factor too. But this is a projection of them allowing, I think it's something like 70 more runs than last season. What are your thoughts there?
Well, that makes perfect sense to me because their best pitcher is gone. That was Wei-Yin Chen. And they've replaced him with maybe Kevin Gausman, although Gausman was kind of projected to hold up anyway. So now it's maybe going to be,
Is it Mike
Mike Wright
Wright or,
or Miguel Gonzalez. And Miguel Gonzalez is a tire fire. And so I
I
hate to
think I
be
saw
so.
Vance, I think I saw Vance Worley in there for a few innings too, which is
Yeah, it,
not
so.
ideal.
Replacing one of those guys with Giovanni Gallardo. I'm not a big Giovanni Gallardo booster, but he is light years better than the rest of those guys. You have to try to make that move if you think that now is your contention window, which with the Orioles, I don't know for sure it is, but you got to kind of go for it in their position, I think.
I thought they were a fit for Matt Latos with Buck Showalter's personality, if there was going to be a manager that could have tamed him. And again, we don't know everything that goes on in the clubhouse. Maybe he isn't as bad of a guy as we think. But did you like them as a fit for a Matt Latos or maybe a lower tier reclamation project like a Chad Billingsley? Obviously, I'm not saying Billingsley specifically. Did you think they were a better fit for those kind of guys than Gallardo, or do you think Gallardo is really the move that they need to make at this point?
I really do think they need some stability. I wouldn't have minded if they went for some reclamation projects. Latos is a good example.
Yeah.
Brandon Beachy, some of these other guys that are maybe injury risks, maybe performance risks, maybe, personality risks, because they have no depth. They have no depth. I mean, when Vance Worley is your go-to, maybe fifth, maybe sixth starter,
Yeah, swing man.
yeah, there's some problems there. And if you look on their AAA team, there's not a lot that they have to work with. They're looking at really low-end NRI guys as the depth behind that. So I would definitely, if I were in their position, maybe have tried to make a couple of other moves. But Gallardo will paper over some of those holes.
Well, beyond that, their farm is really bad too. The other thing though is if their farm is bad, maybe a multi-year deal with Gallardo is preferable to a one-year deal with Latos, a one-year deal with any of these reclamation projects. It's kind of thinking outside the box, but maybe.
Yeah, and the other thing with them is that if they're going to bring on Dexter Fowler and Gallardo, they're giving up two high picks to do that.
Yep.
And for the Orioles, given their track record of drafting pitching, maybe that's not the worst thing in the world. They're not a team that's been terribly successful with their drafts recently.
Yeah, isn't it like pick 14 and pick 29 or 32 or something like that that they're giving up?
I mean, that's two first-round picks. That's not nothing. It makes a pretty nice bonus pool for them, but I mean, at this point, they're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. If they don't try to compete now, the rebuilding process, they really have to Astros it up and tear everything down to try to rebuild again. And when they've just committed all this money to Chris Davis, that seems like it might be kind of untenable. And they don't want to lose Machado because he's a super duper star.
Yeah, the troubling thing there is if you go too far down the road, you let Machado get to be 25, 26, and you're starting over, and you need 3 years to start over, Machado is going to get restless, and you end up trading him, and hopefully it doesn't turn out like a bad Joe Mauer, or not Joe Mauer, a Johan Santana deal where you don't get back value or you don't realize the value that you've received. And it can get really ugly really fast. Now, there was a team too in the American League I wanted to ask you about. What are you making of the White Sox going into 2016?
The White Sox are really in an interesting place because I consider them a lot like the Orioles in that they're kind of in a confusing place right now. They have a bad enough farm system, which is better than it was before, but it's not what I would consider a good farm system, and a competitive to okay major league team, but they have to compete in the AL Central, which is not a cakewalk. I mean, there's a lot of good teams in the Central this year, and there's a lot of teams with a lot of variance. The Tigers could be good. I don't think they'll be real good, but they could be good. The Twins could be very good, or they could be very average. Mm-hmm. The Indians are projected to be very good, but they could be kind of average.
Yeah, they were last year, too.
Exactly, exactly. And you see how those kind of things work out. No one can predict anything. So the White Sox, I feel like, could have really benefited from a couple of impact moves, and they made one of them. Getting Todd Frazier for the package that they gave up was really smart. I really like that deal for them. Beyond that, they could have done more to kind of boost their lineup a little bit. The Brett Lowry trade, I don't know how I feel about him anymore. It's tough to project him to be anything like what we thought he'd be.
He's still impossibly young, though. You forget he's born in 1990. But at the same time, the luster has definitely worn off that 1 year in Milwaukee where he was just playing with his hair on fire, literally and figuratively.
Absolutely. And the thing about him, though, is he is a questionable play. But there were other guys they could have added that would have been a little bit higher upside and a little bit higher floor. Like they could have gone out and gotten a Howie Kendrick or a Daniel Murphy type that would have helped them out. They would have given up a qualifying offer, but there's a lot that goes into play with the White Sox. The end result of what I'd like to say about them is I think they're the worst team in the AL Central. I don't think they're the worst team in the AL Central by a lot, but mm-hmm. And they've got Chris Sale, which means anything's in play, and their left-handed young pitching is really pretty cool. But I don't think they've done enough this offseason to move the needle past the Indians, the Tigers. Well, they probably moved past the Tigers, but the Indians and the Twins specifically, and then the Royals are, as always, are just, you know, anything could happen.
Would you believe me if I told you that the White Sox led the American League in innings pitched and Fangraphs WAR by a rotation?
I would, but only because I've seen you post stuff about Jose Quintana on Twitter.
That's what I get for doing that. But at the same time, replacing Samardzija, even though he was bad, he threw over 200 innings. That's not going to be a joke. Hopefully, Latos, I say hopefully, is guarded optimism because I don't really care what the White Sox do. Whatever happens is going to happen whether I care or not. But I really do like Jose Quintana more than I think a lot of people do. He's a really nice underrated piece that signed a very nice contract for them. They've got their two lefties to just bonkers deals for how good they are. Do you think that they're a team that could benefit a lot from signing maybe, say, Ian Desmond and Austin Jackson? And I know that Jackson's nothing special, but he would be a whole heck of a lot better than not Diane Viciado, but Avisail Garcia in right field, right?
Yeah, before the 2014 season, I projected Garcia to be the worst regular in baseball, and so I feel a little justified in his lack of success. It's disappointing. I would like to see him do well, but at the same time, Austin Jackson is one of those players who's a fit for like 27 teams. I think he would be a nice fourth outfielder for so
really
many
nice.
Different squads.
Really nice. Even the Twins, who I guess I don't necessarily need a fourth outfielder. They got Danny Santana, they got Oswaldo Arcia, and a whole bunch of guys that can play center.
Right.
But there's not a team in baseball that doesn't need a nice fourth outfielder like that.
No, absolutely not. As for Ian Desmond, there's no reason why that team shouldn't go out and get him at this point. I mean, yes, you have to give up the prospect. You have to give up that draft position to get him. But at the same time, he's a perfect fit for the White Sox right now. And I do think he's a good player. I think that Neil Weinberg at Fangraphs has made a pretty good case for that he's not the player that maybe he expects that he is or that we should expect him to be going forward. He's maybe not the same kind of hitter that he was 2-3 years ago. But at the same time, he's a really useful player at a position that the White Sox have nothing at.
Do you sign him to a multi-year deal or a one-year deal?
Well, I think he wants a one-year deal because I think if he has a good season in Chicago, especially like that ballpark, you know, he could tear off 30 home runs, no problem.
Yep. Well, and the other thing there, too, is it's good for both sides. The team can then shift the qualifying offer back on him after a good season. There's a lot to be gained for both sides on a one-year deal. Mm-hmm. I believe that the White Sox also have the prospect, is it Anderson that's the shortstop that they really like that might be ready before too long, too?
Yeah, Tim Anderson. Yep.
Tim Anderson,
and he's likely to be good.
So I mean, the odds of them. This seems like it's pretty much it should be a guarantee that they go out and do this. But at the same time, we're getting to a point where, you know, you're looking at the guys that are unsigned, and you're kind of like, well, what the heck's going on now? this seems like just such an obvious move to you and me, does it not?
Well, it does, but I wouldn't be surprised if the White Sox are thinking, you know what, if we hold out until June, until we hold out, if we hold out past the draft, maybe we can get them without giving up that pick. And so I think that might be, they might be playing a little bit of front office chicken with him. And it would be interesting to see if he holds out, because if that were the case, and then you get into, you know, the April and May years, and then somebody gets injured, and then all bets are off. But I wouldn't be surprised if they're at least holding out some hope still that there might be no other offers for him and they could pick him up late in the game.
Kendry Morales territory.
Exactly.
As far as projection systems, we were talking about Pecota here a few minutes ago. Do you look at any of the other ones, whether it's Zips or Steamer or anything like that?
Oh, absolutely. I like Pecota a lot. You know, yay Baseball Prospectus. Mm-hmm. But I've seen all of the data about which projection systems tend to be the most successful. And with that in mind, you cannot discount Steamer or Zips. They're excellent projection systems. I like to look at all three of those, and then occasionally I'll use Marcel as well. But without you know, being too direct about it, you have to look at the broad range of the projection systems, because the group is usually smarter than just one or two of them.
You mentioned that you wrote a feature at Prospectus about the 2016 award winners using Pecota, and you picked a local guy to win Rookie of the Year in the American League. It might surprise people who you went with, but what did you come out really thinking about for American League Rookie of the Year for 2016?
Well, so I started off by going and looking at the Pecota projections, and Pecota projects Byron Buxton to be worth like 4.5 wins next year.
That's incredible.
Which is staggering. They think that he's going to be the third best defensive player in all of baseball in his first season, which is a big set of expectations to put on somebody. Mm-hmm. They think he's going to be worth 2.5 wins just because he's such a good defensive center fielder. Having seen scouting reports and having seen a little bit of video of him, I don't think that's out of the question, but I think you got to dial that back just a little bit. He's going to be a plus defensive outfielder.
Yep.
I don't think he's going to be able to earn that kind of value in his first season. I think that the guy who's going to benefit the most from Buxton's defense may be some other players on the team who are pitchers. So I picked Jose Berrios. I think he's the guy who is my front runner for the American League Rookie of the Year this year, because the Twins, I feel like the Twins have to use him in the rotation. They have to strike for 2016. And he is possibly right now their best starting pitching option total. I think he may be their best pitcher.
I agree with that.
I love Phil Hughes, but I think Berrios is probably one of the top three pitching prospects in all of baseball. And I think he can succeed immediately with his stuff. So I think that given his situation where he's going to be in the rotation, hopefully for the entire season, you know, barring innings limits, with his stuff being able to translate right away, and with some pretty solid outfield defense behind him in Buxton, I think he's in a really good position to succeed that hardly any other American League pitcher may be. And the American League Rookie of the Year crop doesn't look really great right now. I mean, I would consider three players on the Twins possibilities for that Rookie of the Year award between Berrios, Buxton, and if Kepler gets a shot. But yep, beyond them, there's not a whole lot of other great options in the AL, which may be a result of, you know, everybody coming up from the prospect list last year.
So you talk about the Twins having three Rookie of the Year candidates. Does that, in your mind, justify a pretty quiet offseason for the Twins, or should they have been more proactive?
I don't think it would have hurt if they would have been more proactive, but I feel like with a team like the Twins, you had two options. You either hold pat and maybe wait another year, because I don't think you really hurt yourself long-term by doing that. Mm-hmm. Or if you are going to go out and acquire players, acquire the impact players. Don't mess
Hayward
around. I'm sorry?
I was on the Hayward bandwagon. I know they don't need Jason Hayward, but every team needs Jason Hayward.
Exactly. I loved that idea when you were posting that online.
Yep. Hayward on one side of Buxton, and then I wanted Hicks out there too. Whatever. Kepler's going to be a very nice player. But you can't get stuck in the middle of free agency, the middle road, the Ricky Nolascos and the Irvin Santanas. Either jump into the market headlong, go up to your neck, or stay out altogether. Do the Phil Hughes, you know, low end deals for guys who are under 30. This middle tier stuff is just disastrous for a lot of teams, and that's, they avoid complicating that. They avoided complicating that by doing that this year with like a Yovani Gallardo. But, you know, at the same time, it just, it to me, either jump all the way in or stay out. And the Twins didn't do that.
And the Twins also can't paper over big contracts the same way the Red Sox or the Yankees or other teams can. They just don't have the payroll to do it.
Well, and so the Byung-ho Park signing, I think, makes a lot of sense. It's an impact bat potential. The money is not so much that if he just falls apart, they can't just, you know, put Kenny Vargas there. They can't put Oswaldo Arcia there. You know, they've got time to let him develop and see what his skill set looks like in the big leagues. But at that cost, to get a bat that, in theory, has 30 home run punch in it, yeah, I'll make that move 7 days a week.
Absolutely. The one thing I wish that the Twins had done this offseason is get another starting pitcher. I felt like Scott Kazmir would have been almost like the perfect fit for them as a guy who wouldn't have cost them a draft pick and a guy who could have sucked up some innings and a guy who could have kind of filled out the rotation a little bit.
And the only issue is they view their rotation as crowded already, not from a quality standpoint, definitely a quantity standpoint. And it is already a rotation that will have someone on the outside looking in, whether it's Trevor May, who's obviously a very good reliever, Tyler Duffy, who was really good down the stretch last year, or Ricky Nolasco, who quite frankly just makes a bunch of money. And they don't want to complicate that any further. And then it's also pushing Berrios, however it's supposed to be said, out of the rotation even further too. So, I mean, again, I think it's forcing a false conclusion that Tommy Malone really needs to be promised a rotation spot, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I like Malone as a fifth starter and swingman kind of role or yep. sixth starter. But the whole thing with quantity over quality, it's great. You have to have that kind of depth because, you know, like I was kind of mentioning before, somebody's going to get injured or somebody's going to get suspended for, you know, PEDs in the Twins case. So you've got to be careful about having enough depth. And they do have depth, but they lack the top end guys.
Now, you wrote the Cleveland Indians comments in the BP annual. What were your thoughts when you came away from that team, and why in the heck were they so doggone bad last year? Was it infield defense before they got Urshela and Lindor out there, or what was the thing that was keeping that team from ticking last season?
Well, defense in general was a huge, huge aspect of why they were bad to start the season. If they could have needled out three or four more wins in the first couple of months of the season, they would have been a playoff team.
Right.
So I think that really did hurt them. And it wasn't just the infield, although the infield was awful. The outfield defense wasn't very good either. And it, in a weird event, getting Abraham Almonte, a player who really isn't much more than a fourth outfielder, really helped them out late in the season, which is crazy to think of. And then the move of Lonnie Chisenhall to the outfield, where he went from being a bad defensive third baseman to a really good defensive right fielder. Those kind of things are, you know, it's like the anti-Hanley Ramirez move. When I was reading about the Indians, what I was able to take from that is they have an underrated farm system. They have a lot of really interesting players on the roster, and their pitching rotation is terrifying. I really wouldn't want to go up against them if I were any other team in baseball.
Well, I mean, Trevor Bauer is what, their fourth starter, fifth starter, TJ House in that mix. I guess I don't know beyond the obvious guys with Kluber and Salazar and Carrasco, but when Trevor Bauer is one of your back-end options, and again, he's got his warts, that's a really nice fourth or fifth starter, isn't it?
Yeah, they cut him from the rotation at the end of the year last year. They said, no, you got to go pitch in the bullpen. We got too many other guys. They're one of those teams that has the high-end guys. They've got the depth, and they've even got some guys in AA, AAA who could be on the come-up, Adam Plutko, and my personal favorite is Mike Clevenger. I think he could be a decent starter in that, oh my gosh, he came out of nowhere kind of mold in a year or two. So that's really terrifying. And then their bullpen's pretty good. They've got some really solid guys in there in Allen and Shaw. I'm a big booster for Sean Armstrong. I think he could be a really top-end reliever at some point. They just don't seem to have a lot of holes, with the exception now of their outfield. If Michael Brantley can't start the season, which he doesn't look like he will, if he's out until July or June, which he might be, they could really benefit from a guy like Dexter Fowler, who we've been talking about. Their outfield does look a little dicey.
Yeah, they did. He actually got injured at Target Field. I was actually covering that game, and I actually texted – this is going to sound like a brag, but I texted his agent and said, hey, you know, your guy's not getting up. And So that's a big deal for them. Obviously, his agent is Josh Kuznick, big friend of hopefully this show, but also Baseball Prospectus.
Yeah,
it was disappointing to see that just because he was an MVP candidate the year before and has really turned himself into a nice player. And I hope that things for that team continue to evolve because it is always fun to see those teams that don't always have the spotlight around them succeed. Do you get the sense or do you get the feeling that they could be trying the Alex Gordon path with Chisenhall?
I mean, it's very possible. I think they're going to leave him in the outfield until he fails. Yeah. And I think that's a really good fit for him. I was never a fan of the Royals moving Alex Gordon to the outfield. I always thought they should have kept him there. Obviously, totally wrong. It worked out really nicely for him, and he developed his bat, and his defense is unbelievable. But Chisenhall is never going to hit like Alex Gordon. I mean, that's out of the question, I feel like. He could wind up being a very strong defender in the outfield for a couple of years. He's always going to have a little bit of platoon splits, but it's a way better use of him than putting him at third base. Now, the problem that I do have with the infield for the Indians is that I don't think Urshela is a major league third baseman. I think he's going to get booted from that position pretty quickly.
You're talking about offensively specifically?
Yeah, specifically the offense. I think his third base defense is very solid. But the Indians have a guy at AAA, Yandy Diaz, who came over from Cuba, who's a better defensive third baseman and probably has a higher offensive upside. I just don't see Urshela sticking around for the long term. And if they're one of those teams that could really make an upgrade later on by getting a Juan Uribe trade for somebody.
What about David Freese? Are they a fit for David Freese, who's still unsigned?
I don't know if anybody's a fit for David Freese right now.
But why? Ken Rosenthal tweeted today he might have to take a minor league deal. Like, he wasn't that horrible last year, was he?
No, but his defense is pretty bad. And he's not the offensive player that we think of when we think of, you know, how great he was in the World Series and things like that. He's not really that player either. He's not a big OBP guy, which the Indians like their OBP guys. They like guys who can get on base. It's really tough to find a good spot for him. And I could see him going back to the Angels, no problem, even though they got Escobar.
Is he really going to sign a minor league deal, though?
No, he'll get a major league.
Yeah, that didn't seem to pass the sniff test when I read that. And I don't know if it's somebody trying to drum up interest or what. We're talking about moving players to the outfield. What's your gut reaction to Miguel Sano in the outfield?
My gut reaction is that it's great. I mean, we've seen the guy throw, right? I mean, that's
kind
of
arm. Cannon. He's got a gun.
It's unbelievable. If you pair him next to Buxton, I mean, just maybe cordon off 60% of right field and be like, okay, that's your spot. Don't worry about getting to balls to your right so much. I think you can do okay with him out there. I really like the idea that they're going for it. I personally, my kind of wheelhouse for baseball is I think guys should play all sorts of weird positions. I advocated moving Joe Mauer to third base.
Oh, right. You guys have Ben Zobrist. No, you went after Ben Zobrist. That's right. You don't have Ben Zobrist. I opened up an old wound there. But you like the guys that have that kind of versatility.
I love it. And so I think moving Sano to the outfield is a great idea because, you know, with the other assets that the Twins have, you've got Plouffe, you've got Mauer, you've got, Park, the guy that you've brought in. Why not try him out there? And if he fails miserably, then it's not like they're not going to move him to DH. I mean, he's good enough to play no matter what his defense is. But I love the idea of giving him a shot out there.
Well, and when you look at him physically in person, not on TV, you look at a guy that's that built, and the weight is you know, he's a heavier guy, but you look at him, you're just like, there's probably not much this guy can't do on the baseball field if he puts his mind to it and gets the right tutelage. The other thing is, I believe, and I don't know how much speed matters in right field, but I think on his first big league triple, StatCast had him reaching like 20 miles per hour rounding second base. So there's obviously enough high-end speed where even if it's only a career move for him until Trevor Plouffe is out of Minnesota, it can be a tenable situation where he doesn't kill the fly ball guys like Glenn Perkins, like Phil Hughes, the guys that kind of gravitate towards that type of balls in play profile. I see him physically and I'm just thinking, man, there's not much he can't do on the baseball field. Let's give this a whirl.
Yeah, absolutely. Even with the bigger guys, I'm always fascinated when you look at the StatCast data or you just time them going to first. These guys are incredible athletes. And, you know, no, is he going to be Aaron Hicks in right field? No, he's not going to be that kind of defensive player. But he can get to a lot of things. And you'll be surprised sometimes the size of some of these guys, the range they're able to cover. And that's what I'm really excited about seeing some of the StatCast data for.
So with your writing, what is your specialty as far as, you know, when people – hopefully listen to this and then start following you both on Twitter and your writing. What things do you most enjoy writing about?
Well, one of the things that I guess I probably the two articles that I write more often that tend to get the most interest are I write about the McEwing score, which is a number that I give to multi-position players. I love watching guys move around the diamond. I'm always advocating to move people. I think in 2014 I wrote an article about, like, it's such a great idea that the Indians are moving Carlos Santana to third base, or things like that, which, you know, I'm wrong all the time, but I really like to see those kind of things. And then I like to write about the guys who play multiple positions, that your Brock Holtz, your Joe McEwings, your Alexi Amarista type guys. So that's one of the things. I do a lot of transaction analysis now for Baseball Prospectus. And then I also, one of the things that I'd like to get back to is the WAR Index, which I developed a good scaled methodology for combining the FanGraphs, the Baseball Reference, and the Baseball Prospectus wins above replacement metrics, scaled them all to each other, and then was able to give kind of a more holistic view of some people, which is great, especially for pitchers, which have wildly different systems for value.
Yeah, I totally dig that. Let's you want to do a little lightning round before we let you go?
Let's do it.
All right. Sleeper team in the American League. I'm putting you on the spot, so if you got to pull up a window or something, you know, do you think Oakland, for instance? I think the American League is bananas. There's literally all 15 teams could feasibly contend. My sleeper team, I think maybe Tampa isn't a sleeper team because of your guys' projection. So in that case, I'll take the White Sox.
I think that the Tampa counts, and I think the White Sox count. I'm going to go with Seattle. I was really high on them last year. I know they've turned over half the roster, but a lot of the main players are still there, so I'll go with them.
Who's your sleeper National League team? It's really hard to have one.
Yeah, it's usually pretty obvious as who's going to do well. I'm going to go a little bit off the sabermetric beaten path, and I'm going to say the Diamondbacks.
Ah, you took mine.
Okay, good.
My favorite move of theirs is signing Mike Farron to a big contract to be their studio. No.
They can't mess up.
They can't mess up. Making great moves. Obviously, the trades with Atlanta has become kind of a weird thing, but they had a really great offense last year. They addressed the pitching staff. They're going to be interesting. I definitely think so. As far as the National League, what are your thoughts on pretty much every rebuilding team being in the National League? There's really nobody in the American League rebuilding, but there's like six teams in the National League doing so.
It's weird, and it's only going to be like a year that this is the case, because I definitely think that once we see how the AL is going to shake out, that some teams are really going to tear it down. The Athletics are kind of like a sneaky rebuilding team. Like, I kind of feel like they do this thing that I coined as pre-building, where they just get more assets that they can trade later for more assets.
Yeah.
It's kind of becoming very strange to me, but I think it's one of those things that things kind of move in cycles. And I think by the end of next year, you'll see that the Phillies may be a little bit done rebuilding. The Braves may be pulling back a little bit on that. And you could definitely see a team that does poorly in the AL this year kind of go in that other direction, whether it's the Yankees or the White Sox or even, you know, dare I say it, the Twins.
Do you think the Rockies are rebuilding, or are they just confused?
I have no idea what they're doing. I don't think anybody does. I really don't know. And now they've got kind of a cool farm system. So why are they not just going for it and just ripping that thing down? I don't know.
The AL on the whole is bananas. If you had to pick one team that was not going to contend and one team that was going to make the playoffs for sure, who are you picking?
The one team that I would say is going to make the playoffs for sure is the Houston Astros.
That's a good pick. I love that Ken Giles acquisition.
I mean, they've done everything right this offseason, I feel like. It's hard to pick against them. They're very deep right now. If there was one team in the American League that I would say is not going to make it, it would have to be the Athletics. I just think that the West is a little bit too loaded. Even the bottom half of those teams, those are not much worse than 80-win teams other than the Athletics. I think they're my pick.
Who had a worse offseason, the Angels or the Rockies?
Man, these are impossible questions. I would say the Rockies did, simply because they made that bizarre Dickerson for McGee trade. I like Jake McGee, but he was the wrong guy to get for Corey Dickerson.
Which team is more likely to return to the World Series, the Mets or the Royals in 2016?
It hurts me. It physically hurts me, but the Royals. How do you argue with a team that was in the World Series for the past 2 years?
And it's also a gauntlet in the National League. It's amazing how good the pitching and how good everything around that situation of the National League is, where literally any of those teams between the Mets, Cubs, Dodgers, Pirates, and Cardinals all, and then you're still leaving out somebody like the Nationals.
There's and gonna be the Giants.
Yeah, there's going to be a team that wins probably 90. I know the projections say otherwise, but somebody's going to win, what, 92, 93 games and miss the playoffs in the National League?
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all. I think there's six or seven really good teams that are going to be in contention for the playoffs, and some 90-win team is going to be left out. You're right.
All right, tell me where these unsigned free agents are going to land, and we'll let you go. Ian Desmond.
Chicago. I think the White Sox.
Dexter Fowler.
Orioles.
And Yovani Gallardo.
All right, I'm trying to think of another option for him if the Orioles don't go there. I do think it's going to be the Rockies are so weird. No way, man. I could see him winding up on a team that needs an extra flippable asset. So I'm going to go San Diego if the Orioles don't take him.
Ooh, I like it. And then Austin Jackson.
Austin Jackson. For him,
give me Cleveland on this one.
Oh, Cleveland is good. Oh, that's a really good one.
But they signed Rajay Davis, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. They added Rajay Davis. I'm going to go with Toronto.
Ooh, I like that. Well, that's going to be it. That's going to be a wrap for episode number 7 of Midwest Swing. One last time, Brian, where can we find your reading and where can we find you on Twitter?
Baseball Prospectus, Baseball Prospectus Boston, Beyond the Box Score, and my Twitter is at B. Grossnick.
This is Brandon Warren at Brandon_Warren. Thanking you for joining us on Midwest Swing on the Cold Omaha Podcast Network.
Hey there, it's Sam Ekstrom, and I'm here to tell you that I'm not perfect. I have vices. Most of us do. Maybe you're like Peyton Manning and you enjoy Budweiser. Maybe you can't resist Dairy Queen blizzards. Maybe you're into e-cigs. Hey, no judgment. I enjoy betting on sports. And if you also enjoy betting on sports for a little entertainment, you'll love the podcast featuring yours truly, Sam Ekstrom, along with Sam Verhulst, part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. Available on iTunes and on Stitcher. Don't dread the spread. Turn your nickels into dimes.
Hey guys, this is Tom Schreier, co-founder of ColdOmaha.com. Thank you for listening to the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes and leave us a comment and a rating. Also, don't forget to check out ColdOmaha.com to see all of our podcasts and read articles about your favorite teams in the Twin Cities. If you have any suggestions or comments on anything related to Cold Omaha, email us at editors@ColdOmaha.com or follow us on Twitter @ColdOmahaMN.